Welcome to Foundation and Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. This week, we're covering Season 1, Episode 1, The Emperor's Peace, and Episode 2, Preparing to Live. Respect and enjoy the podcast. All right, Aaron, before we get started here, I want to hear what you think about the episodes, but I also want to know, for people who might be new to Bald Move and haven't listened to us before, I want to know who the hell you are and what your relationship with Foundation is.
Well, as you said, my name's Aaron, and I first read the Foundation series back in junior high and high school, and I have read the main sequence of the Foundation series, but I have not read any of the prequels or the sequels that were written in like the later part of the 80s. And I still remember a good deal of the main plot and the characters, but it's also been a little hazy. I haven't read this since I was a teenager, so it's been 20, 30 years at best. And I'm a little bit hazy, but I'm not completely going in here blind. How about you, Jim?
As you said, I'm Jim. And I read the series about 20 or 30 days ago. Not actually the whole series either. A couple of months ago, I picked up Foundation audiobook and listened through that and was pretty surprised, pretty bummed out that I hadn't picked it up before because it was so good. And I think as a teenager, that would have been really compelling to me. But here I am, you know, as a 39-year-old man checking out the books for the first time and really liking them. And then we're back to the series. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, I do want to say, because I think one question a listener might have in their mind is, oh my God, these guys have read the books. Someone more recently, someone read more along the way. Oh my God, it's going to be one of those podcasts where they're always comparing, you know, and saying, this isn't as good and spoiling me for other things. That's a valid concern, because I know a lot of podcasts kind of do that. But like, we have done this several times with the Walking Dead podcast. You know, we had both read the comics far in advance of where that series had been to points. We've done The Expanse, where you've read the books in advance. Did the Game of Thrones, where I'd read the books in it. We're pretty good at separating what we know from you. Like, we might have at the end of the podcast like a discussion about the books versus the series, or we might have some speculation about how we think what we know about the series is going to shape the books, but we're always going to mark that really well in case there are spoilers for people to want to remain absolutely pure. So, you know, you can respect and enjoy the podcast is what I'm saying.
Yeah. All right. Now, what do you think of these first two episodes?
I was nervous because I've obviously, if you listen to a preview episode, I was very excited. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. And then Thursday night, I think it was, I saw Alan Sepinwall released at the embargo his review of the whole series. He's seen the first 10 episodes and he kind of shat on it. I mean, he didn't shit on it, but he was getting a mediocre rating. It was two and a half stars out of five possible, which is usually the type of ratings on stuff that I don't engage with. So I started getting really nervous because I respect Alan Sepinwall. He's my favorite TV critic by far. We very rarely disagree, but we do occasionally disagree. We don't see eye to eye. I think that he was notoriously pretty blind to the brilliance of True Detective Season 1. I think he was slow to really get and engage with The Leftovers, although he eventually came around, I think, on both of those. So I was kind of like, there's a couple points, I think, in the second episode, especially, where I'm like, oh, man, maybe this is just jointed and all over the place. But they're always resolved at like, oh, they're running a simulation. That's why we it was just my kind of fears. I actually thought the first two episodes were great. Like, it was recognizably the plot I remember from reading the books, all the main beats, but so much richer. Like,
yeah.
Gale gets so much more development in this first two episodes than they do in the entire book series, as far as I can remember. And, you know, just having someone like Jared Harris play Harry Seldon is such a boon, because he brings so much gravitas and also kind of approachability and warmth that it does a lot of heavy lifting. It's just like Lee Pace brings a lot of imperiousness to the role of him, like just yeah. him being him brings a lot to that role. And my God, some of the special effects,
yeah,
some of the design work. It's I thought these first two episodes are really gripping and appropriately mysterious. Like the way they're doing some of the time jumps is like a little bit of a spoiler or a tease to some of the mysteries that are probably laying later on. I thought were great. And I also don't think that there's many opportunities for people new to the series to get lost. Like they explained everything. Like what is psychohistory? Mm-hmm. What is the state of the Imperium? I felt like all that stuff, maybe concepts like this, like people, I don't know if people got the whole Star Bridge and what that meant, but I was really excited. I've never seen a space elevator depicted in visual fiction before. And yeah. I've also remember reading some proposal. Well, I don't want to get too far. What did you think of that? These two episodes?
I largely agree with you. I think from an artistic standpoint, this is a resounding success. It looks like nothing else on television. It looks better than 99% of anything I've ever seen. Both, you know, in visualizing like conceptual stuff, like jump drives in an interesting way. And also just in like its polish, right? There is CG all over this thing, but it never feels like it.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know if that comes down to the Art Deco stylings that sort of make it feel grounded in a weird way or what. But yeah, I always felt like absorbed into the universe that it was portraying based on the visuals. And I think the storytelling is the thing that I was most concerned about with this adaptation, because the novels are very, very dry, extremely dry. Like, I couldn't tell you a character that had a personal moment in the entire first book. And the show is trying to do a little bit more with personalizing these stories, making characters that you can get caught up in the lives of, right? And emotionally right. connected to. I think it's like the weakest part of the show because that's not what the books are. But I don't think it's the weakest part because it's not what the books do. I think it's the weakest part because they had to do so much heavy lifting there for me to start to care about these characters that I don't know. I felt like a little out of touch with them, even with the work they were doing. But I will say, you know, as far as taking these gigantic concepts and putting people in the center of them, I think it's doing a respectable job. It's about as good of an adaptation as I could possibly imagine so far.
Yeah, I know a lot of things felt rushed, and like in particular the relationship between Gale and Raish. Like, in fact, when I watched it through the second episode, I was kind of shocked that we just jumped to them being in a relationship. Like, well, I guess they've been, you know, who yeah. knows, they could have been floating for a year, 2 years, who knows. They're young people. They're both very attractive. I'm, you know, that shit happens all the time, right? So I don't need my handheld. I don't need to see their first, right? So,
sure.
But it is unusual because they're having to tell such a big story that they don't, like, you know, it would be more effective if they took the time to really develop those characters and the relationship instead of doing it all in essentially 2 hours of television. But they, like Harry Seldon, don't have the time.
Yeah, most shows do have that time, right? Because that's what they're about. Right. But this show is about right. something bigger. And so it's hard to get right. that stuff to connect quite as well as other shows. And I think that might be why Steppenwolf had a bit of a problem with it, because he's used to those smaller stories that you tell on television where you really connect strongly to the main characters. I think, you know, that might get in the way of enjoying something that's bigger like this. And hopefully, as we see the show play out in what I hear is supposed to be an 8-season run, if it gets the full run, we'll start to connect not just with these characters on the small scale, but with the foundation and with like the overall narrative of this empire.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like when I heard 8 seasons, I still think that's a lot. But I also remember very clearly when I first started thinking about the Expanse, or I became aware of the Expanse, and I was like at the, you know, like going through like a good portion of season 1. I remember thinking, how the hell is this a 9-book series? Like, Jesus, like what, you know, how? And then they like kick the lid off with the protomolecule. And yeah. then like they keep like and that like is even just the beginning of like And I think people might be like, well, how is the cycle of history going to hold up to like eight seasons? But the thing is, it's like there's a lot of crucial things about cycle history that you learn along the way that like throw, you know, curveballs into it. And the question is, was Harry smart and insightful enough into the math to anticipate those? And how do you anticipate things that you can, you know, by design, not know? Like, it reminds me of like during the Gulf Wars where Donald Rumsfeld would say, you know, you've got your knowns, you got your known unknowns, you got your unknown unknowns, like the thing, you know, and this series plays a lot with that, you know, like what can fuck up psychohistory? If psychohistory, your predictions get, you know, start to drift, how do you get things back on track? In fact, I think they don't declare them, but I think we might have seen a few of those happen in these two episodes.
And psychohistory plays at a lot of larger concepts, right, that they're introducing here, like the idea of what is truth, the idea of faith in institutions versus faith in, let's call it faith in science. There's a lot of big questions that are being bandied about in these first two episodes that I assume they're going to delve into a lot more. And I'm super interested to see how they develop psychohistory, because like I said, I've only read the first novel. So that novel goes about 80 years into the story. This story must span a lot more time than that. I'm curious to see how this all plays out, because I don't even really know.
And that's the one thing that really irked me about Sepinwall's review, is he's like, you know, even when he's giving credit to the visuals, which again, we're going to talk about this more here in a minute, but in 4K, oh my God, these things look so good.
Dude.
But he's like, you know, this transport looks like Luke's space speeder, and this thing looks like a space station from Star Trek. And I'm like, damn, Asimov literally invented the concept of the geosynchronous satellite and galactic empires and all these other things that like Star Wars heavily bid on. Like, also you can see a lot of like the, you know, influence in Frank Herbert's Dune, and the accusation of like copying, like what?
It's adapting source material that invented it. Yeah, it's tough.
Right. I'm sorry. There's only so many ways to visualize a hover space car and an object that would inhabit. But like, even then they are, like you said, with that jump drive stuff. Maybe this is a good time to just talk about, because I want to talk about some of the artistry. I want to talk about the characters, the themes and concepts. And then maybe we can talk about some differences between books and show. Let's start talking about the artistry, because it's clear to me that Amazon really spared no expense.
Amazon probably would have spent twice as much, but Apple spared no expense.
Apologies to Bait. No, I don't apologize. Apple didn't. Like, you can see the budget on the screen. Like, it's just amazingly crisp, and it's endlessly inventive in the costuming and the wardrobes. Or anything in particular that stuck out to you?
Let's talk about the jump drive, because that was easily the coolest thing I saw, and I've never quite seen anything like it. I've seen a lot of hyperspace. You want to talk about Star Wars, you see a lot of lines blurring off into the horizon, into nothing. This was different. This was a ship creating what I assume is a wormhole, a gravitational tunnel out to a different part of space. And it looked amazing. I kept wondering, like, what is it going to do? Like, OK, I've seen stuff like this in Contact a little bit, right? With the spinning rings around the center with the human inside.
Interstellar had a little bit of that with just the concept of the gate and the what was the gargantuan? I forget what the name of the giant black hole is, but like it looks like it spawned a black hole in the middle of the ship, folded space around it, and then fucking took off in one direction.
Yeah.
And its entry and exit into, I guess, hyperspace or wormhole space or whatever is just so fucking cool, and I've never ever seen anything like that before.
And it's paired with also their depiction of a stasis pod, which I've seen depicted hundreds of times, right? In many different ways. The one that springs to mind immediately is Alien. I don't know why we watched that recently, but Aliens did that. And this is a really cool visualization of it. It's got some kind of mesh that encompasses someone in. It almost looks like a carbonite kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. Except made of mesh.
Right.
I was a little curious about how the stasis field goes wrong. And when you wake up in the middle of it, they talk about how your mind and your body can diverge a bit. But I don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. I assume at some point in the future, we'll know more about that, because that's exactly what happens to Gail. I'm sorry. I listened to the audiobook version of that first novel, and they call her Gal in that.
It's just cool. Like, I've seen black holes have only recently been depicted, I guess, as we understand, by scientific principles. If you could actually see what these look like, here's what it would look like. You get this big. And it also demonstrates, I guess, we mentioned in the preview how they really blur in some of these works. You're going to see the line between magic and technology blurred. And I think these mesh suits, the shrouding, the black, like, how the hell did they do it? You don't know, but this just demonstrates the power that the Empire can command, that they can, for purposes of essentially recreational travel. I mean, I get the idea this is first class travel as opposed to the slow boats to Terminus and all that stuff, which are still faster than light. But like, it just gives you an idea of how fucking powerful and how much hubris a society would have when they can master all these elemental forces. And it also makes you wonder, I mean, this is the bigger picture things about how is there scarcity and want in this galaxy? Like, if you can just generate a black hole for travel, presumably probably to generate power, like, how the hell are there like have not systems out there that are running around wanting to foster rebellions against you?
Well, because you've got the Empire, right? And we'll talk about
the hubris, right? Right.
Pretty
right.
soon. But I love that depiction. I love the idea of a star bridge, right? That's just really cool. I think like this is the first space elevator I've seen depicted in any, let's say, moving visual medium. I'm sure it's been in comics and stuff, but it was very impressive.
It's not even, you don't even see the concept of the space elevator depicted in written fiction. Do you want, because since it is such a new concept, it's not a new concept. They've been talking about it for 34 years.
And this
years.
Is not part of that magical stuff, right? This is part of the stuff that we think, it is, because we don't have the material science to do it, but we know that it could be done if we did have the materials.
So do you want to describe the concept of a space elevator and why it's so cool?
I think I understand it. As I understand it, it is essentially a satellite that is attached to the Earth via a long ass cable. In this case, it looks like it's a whole ass structure, right? It's not just a cable that you ride up. It's not like a cable car.
I've always seen it described as like a strong car or like carbon nanotube tether or something that.
And when you think about it, you're like, oh, that'd be like the size of my arm. No, it'd probably be more like the size of a skyscraper. What's depicted here, right?
Where right.
To get the tensile strength, but then.
Especially when we're 12,000 years into humanity's future at a minimum. That's how long the Empire has lasted. So you're talking like we're maybe a couple hundred years away from even attempting a space elevator. So they got a space tower cable, but it's still a flexible system. So anyway,
the reason this is useful is because you can escape Earth's orbit or Earth's atmosphere with a lot less power, right? You don't need rockets that are firing you up against the draw of gravity. You can pull yourself up along this cable, I guess.
And if with the cable sufficient length attached to the Earth's equator, it essentially just like a pitcher's arm, when something at the top is let go, it can just launch things like so much cheaper get into the travel all throughout the solar system, because you'd have a lot of inertia and velocity. You wouldn't have to spend all that power getting out of the steepest part of Earth's gravity well, and as you say, the atmosphere. But I even remember early like papers talking about the concept. They said, one of the real risks is if the structure would be the tether ever breaks, depending like if it breaks at the base, it would do it. I've heard if it breaks at the base, it'd be just like weird, kind of like was wobbling chain, just score gouging all over the Earth. But if it severs closer up, that cable The optimum length of a space elevator that I was reading about, like if it ever fell to the Earth, it would wrap around the planet several times.
Which isn't that exactly what happens in the show?
And it would get faster and faster, like a cracking a whip. The last bits of those chains would be hitting the Earth at like supersonic speeds. And you can see like there's a line where he's like that the space bridge is encircling our planet like a garret.
Yeah.
Like, and it gouges like, what was it, 50 layers deep into this Coruscant like city structure.
They call it the scar. That was so cool.
The scar is beautiful and terrifying. And like, again, not only have I never seen that realized in concept, but like the destruction and having it seen like it obviously. That's not a concept in Foundation. I don't think Asimov ever dreamed of a space elevator in his lifetime, but it's cool to see that these guys are hardcore science fiction nerds and have done their research on the concept and how much damage you can do with a terrorist attack to one if you don't respect the piece.
Yeah, that's the thing about the Foundation novels. They're written in the 40s, the original ones, and it's like the height of its technology is essentially nuclear engines, right? Nuclear reactions. And I mean, that could be useful for some things, but it certainly doesn't get you, at least not at the scale he was talking about, to things like black holes.
There's also other things like small things like Harry puts his hand through this active glass, like instead of opening like a bookcase, it just kind of like opens around his hand to retrieve something. I thought that was cool.
The Emperor's different shrouding. Have personal shields. That is demonstrated, I think, collars. In the second episode.
Yep. I thought that was, and I don't know how impervious those are. I'm sure we'll find out before the series is over. That's not like me knowing anything. I'm just saying that it seems like, yeah, because that's the other thing is this concept of the Emperor. I believe the Emperor in the book was called Emperor Cleon, but he's a very minor figure.
Yeah. Because he's like, in like two chapters in the first of the book and then he's gone.
Especially as essentially revolving around Harry's trial, which happens pretty much exactly how it does in this show, I think. But this is like now that you've got this genetic dynasty, which I thought is a cool idea. It doesn't really have anything to do with the artistry. Maybe we can save that for the characters. I also liked the costuming.
Yeah,
I felt like it's very hard to imagine future fashion because like just look 400 years ago and see what people were getting up to in Europe. The tights and the plumed feather and the ruffled sleeves and like, you know, that how would you ever imagine a suit or a bikini from those times? Right. Mm-hmm. But like Gale's planet living in these like cabbage patch, translucent get ups, all the Imperial citizens had kind of distinct looks depending on what world they came from. I thought the Emperors all being dressed as like dusk and dawn and the day. I thought all that stuff was really cool and distinctive. There's a few things where like I thought some of Raish's outfits got almost into like, was it Rufio from Hook kind of territory?
Yeah.
Like very asymmetrical and yeah. But like, you know, sometimes fashion's like that, you know, every once in a while you get bell bottoms and shit that don't look right. But I thought the attention to detail in the costuming was because even you could kind of tell by looking the future lawyers, you know, and the diplomats and like the businessmen. Yeah. They're kind of, but also like that's nothing like what they would wear today. I thought that stuff was really cool.
Let's talk about the intro, which is very cool. It gives me let's talk about it hand in hand with sort of this mural that they're painting. What do they call the stuff that they're painting this mural with? There's some kind of like ability for it to morph and move and change.
Active chroma is what they call it.
Active chroma. And I get that same impression from the intro as well, right? Like things are built of the sands of time almost, right? It's fitting that they use this for a mural depicting all the different events in the galactic or the imperial timeline, because you get a sort of sands of time vibe. You get a like Egyptian sort of permanence of power.
Yeah.
Kind of vibe from the opening of this, where they're showing a lot of like, you know, faces that are like carved of stone, but made up of all these grains of sand. And
Right.
It evokes like the emotion of some immovable power. And I really love that. And also just like they tie it into the universe as a whole, right? Like the galaxy that this empire is in is also there in the background, and it's the truly unmovable thing, right? It's the ultimate power in the galaxy is the galaxy itself kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's really cool. Well, I loved it.
You mentioned the Egyptian, and I got the same thing. I'm like, this reminds me a lot of the like Prince of Egypt sequence where Moses is discovering the dark past of the Israelis and Egyptian relations, or at least the biblical version of that history. Mm-hmm. And like all the hieroglyphics are kind of merging and shifting and moving along the walls. But you can't think of Egyptian hieroglyphs, or at least I can't, and especially in the context of this story, without thinking of the Ozymandias poem about sure. like this guy who's had these monuments carved in his name, and you know, like they're half buried in the sand, and then they're inscribed like, "Gaze upon my works, ye mighty, in despair," even though this thing's in ruins.
Right.
And you can't, there's so much of that illusion too, like the space elevator pointedly destroys one of the many golden effigies of the empire. Which yeah. I like the way they referred to the emperor in total as empire, like he is yeah. the empire. So I got big Ozymandias energy from some of this stuff. Again, that theme of like hubris.
Makes a ton of sense. The music is okay in this intro. I'm not a fan of weak melodies in my intros. I like very strong melodies with repetition and stuff, but like this is okay.
Yeah, I'm wondering because like there's a lot of stuff I recognize, obviously, in the introduction, like the slave one looking jump ships, you know.
Yeah.
The Imperial cruisers, we see one of the Emperor Dusk take one of those to the Scar. Mm-hmm. These unbroken chain of emperors are kind of like blowing away in the sand. But then we see this huge robe statue. We see this like angel monument. This filigreed version of Harry's Tesseract that he calls the, what is that thing called?
The Prime?
Prime Radiant.
Radiant, yes.
The Prime Radiant. I thought that stuff was all cool. And obviously, like, I'm thinking that big hooded robed statue and the angel monument kind of thing are going to be, I don't know, some kind of transitional governments or structures or movements that come out of all this, because I'm expecting that a lot. Like if the empire falls and it's going to be fallen for 1,000 years, what are the forces that are number one? Like who are the ones that attacked? It doesn't seem like it was the official governments of these two border worlds or outer rim worlds. What are these factions that are they're going to war with each other? And maybe those are representations of those different movements and stuff. But we'll probably figure out as the series goes on.
One of the other things I love about the very strong visual motif they're developing is how it ties into the Prime Radiant, as you mentioned, because that is, as we find out in these first two episodes, the representation mathematically of Harry Seldon's teachings of psychohistory, right? It's like these are the equations that if you can view these kind of like watching, you know, tech code scrolling down a matrix screen, if you're trained in it, you can decipher it and you can understand it. And I think like in so much as mathematics is simply a way to describe the universe, it really ties in strongly with that sand motif comprising the universe, right? And the particles that all this is made up, the stardust, right? All of it is math in a certain point of view. And so I think like the motif they're developing with that sand stuff and these moving particles is really, really strong. And I really liked it.
I also like that, like, you know, we've seen in recent years, Devs is a prime example of this concept of being able to predict, a deterministic universe. Because yeah. like if you could model every particle down to the subatomic levels in the universe, you would need you could maybe, I don't know, depending on how you understand uncertainty, but maybe you could just like literally rewind and fast forward time and predict whatever you want. A lot of people say that, you know, some of the uncertainty and the underlying fabric of the universe would preclude that from happening. And also, you know, you would need more particles in the known universe to construct your machine to model it. Then so like you got some problems with this concept.
Yeah,
I like this psychohistory, I think, is my favorite version of this thing where it's like, it's more of a probability matrix that, like, you can kind of extrapolate baseline humans' behavior and what they'll do, not individually, but over larger populations. And when you get to populations the size of, you know, what, 8 trillion citizens of the empire, the shit can't, it gets more and more rock solid. But that raises questions of, like, you know, how big is the population of Terminus going to be? Can you correctly, you know, when you need to, like, macro predict the survival of one single colony, is that as useful? I thought the way they expressed that and kind of, like, brought those concepts to life, we'll probably talk more into the concept portion, but I thought that was great. The other things I thought were really great from artistry is, like, the little dwarf planet research lab. That was really cool. It looked amazing in 4K. I liked and maybe, is there anything that didn't quite work for you? Because I thought there was a couple things, like, I wasn't sure how I felt about the gold Praetorian guard looking soldiers. Like, they looked, I thought, kind of goofy to me.
Where were they?
They were, like, escorting the coffins through the spaceport, and they were, like, usually in attendance around the Emperor. I think, because you also see later, like, rank and file soldiers, and they're looking a lot more futuristic bodyguard. Like, so I think these guys are just, like, the look impressive, not to actually be impressive. But I thought that they just, I don't know, their design just looked a little too Liberace meets Stargate to me.
Okay.
But I also,
yeah, I mean,
also
thought most of it is based on Art Deco stuff, right? So you're going to have a lot of sort of interesting looking stuff.
Yeah. I also thought the null field visualization was a little weak. But again, I also don't know how you portray something that is just a field that repulses all living things somehow. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'll give him one on that.
It's hilarious to me because I was thinking about the sci-fi concepts in this world, and in relation to the null field, it's clearly got to be some kind of gravity based thing, right? They're punching wormholes into the fabric of space time. That's gravity based, I'm sure. The time when it really struck home to me that they have mastered gravity and control thereof is when I saw Gale swimming in a pool that was on a spaceship that was not thrusting in the direction of the top of the pool. And I was like, oh, they have some way to control, like, inertial dampeners, whatever it is, like in Star Trek, some way to control the gravity that keeps the water in the pool from a different angle than the thrust is providing. So, like, I don't know why that's when it clicked with me, when they have already got wormholes and, you know, gravitic fields probably keeping you away from the vault. So,
yeah, space swimming pools is how you impress upon Jim Jones your galaxy-spanning techno-empire credentials. Wormholes for engines, nah, get the... I've seen Romulans do that in Star Trek. Come on, that's not... That's only 400 years in the future. Yeah. The bastard offshoots of the Vulcans can come up with that.
So there's also other stuff with the artistry here, like the landscapes and just the cinematography itself, right? Outside of the effects, I think... They must have been filming where they filmed season 4 of The Expanse or something, because these, like, I don't know, Icelandic volcano hellscape type planets that they're doing at the very beginning for Terminus very much reminded me of those places. They have, you know, the very CG heavy, essentially Coruscant, right? If you want to talk about who ripped off who, well, Coruscant in Star Trek is just Trantor in this. So that was really cool to see. And the depiction of it too was interesting. It's got sort of, I guess, screens in the underground levels to fake a night. Well, we saw it as a nighttime sky, but I assume they could do any time of day. That's something that I haven't seen depicted in Star Wars. I thought that was all very cool. And then you've got, you know, the literal, they're with the visuals here, they're literally separating the classes into the upper classes, the people living kind of on the surface of this massive city, who see a real sky, who breathe real fresh air. And then you've got the underclasses, which are literally beneath them, right? Literally, you couldn't take the metaphor any closer to a literal depiction here. Yeah, I thought that stuff is really cool, and it looks very neat.
Separated by literal glass ceilings that can't be penetrated.
Right.
As far as the landscapes, I agree with everything you said, except for I thought the Terminus landscape, the one flaw was where they showed the ocean. I thought there's clearly some fuckery going on with the water, but I'm not sure if that's supposed to be water. Because I remember I saw a video game that was depicting some kind of planetary ocean, and it looked unnatural. And I remember thinking, like, Jesus Christ, it's 2019 or whatever, that I've seen better water than this. And then I read in the game design notes that actually on this planet, the oceans are made out of hydrocarbons, like essentially that those would flow and the waves would look different and stuff. So I was like, maybe these things are made out of, like you said, ammonia. Because there's some kind of weird crystalline structure that's forming, and maybe it's ice, or maybe it's just I don't know. But like the boundary layer between that looked fudged, and in a way that, again, everything else is so crisp. I thought the null fields and that stuff were the ones, the digital effects that kind of didn't stand out or didn't look right. Everything else, like, they do a good job of like not making the technology look like when you see the inside of this robot figure, we'll talk about later. Like, there's no recognizable, like, you don't see pistons or circuit boards, or it looks like some organic mesh that's got some kind of power system but like, who the fuck isn't? She just kind of spray paints over her wound. Like, it's you'd look at that and you'd say, that's magic. That's not governed by any scientific principles that I understand or realize.
Yeah.
Do you want to move on to talking about the themes?
Yeah, for sure.
All right, let's take a quick break and we'll get right back and talk about that. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
No lunch this week, as I'll be traveling on vacation, but get ready for next week when we have the rare, elusive, dare I say premium lunch with Talitha and Aaron.
And while you're waiting for the return of the king, don't forget, May is the time to switch your Patreon tiers to make sure you maintain your full benefits by June. Stop by support.baldmove.com to check your Patreon levels to see the new benefits and decide which one is right for you.
And finally, tickets are now on sale for Badass Fest 6. Come meet us live and in person, watch a mystery badass film with us, and then hear us record the podcast right there in front of you in a theater packed with Bald Move fans. Get your details and your tickets at baldmove.com/live.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com right now to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. Okay, Jim, we've talked a lot about psychohistory so far. Is there anything else we need to kind of like plumb those depths? Because I think the show does a pretty good job of explaining the science of it, the quote unquote science.
Yeah. I think the most interesting thing that they do with it at the beginning is set it up as a way to tell macro future, but not micro future. As Harry says in the trial, I can't really tell what you're going to have for dinner, but I can predict that the empire is going to fall in 500 years. And by doing that, they set up a tension with Gale as to whether or not she's going to back Harry, right? Whether or not this character is willing to go along with these macro predictions that may or may not happen. I mean, they're 500 years from knowing, right? But if she looks at the formulas, like, will she tell him? And you don't know, because Harry couldn't have predicted her actions. He couldn't have said, I'll bring in Gale and she will 100% back me on this, and the Emperor will do this because I've predicted everyone's movements down to the nth degree. No, he just knows the macro. And so there's a big tension about whether or not she's going to come in here and lie for the Empire or follow the science. And I thought that was interesting.
And not just the cycle history doesn't just break down between large scale and small scale, because there's always a probability. He's like, you know, like, yeah, there's a non-zero chance that you won't be arrested, but it's really not worth talking about. But clearly other things kind of worry him. And I like the way that they made cycle history cool. Like, it feels like Ocean's 11, you know, where it's like when the Empire comes, I'm like, okay, well, let's just set your foundation. We're just going to put you on a slow boat to the outer edge of the universe, far away from us, so you can just essentially be cut off. And that was a defeat. It felt like a defeat until you start realizing Harry knows an awful lot about this backwater planet, and Gale realizes, oh my God, this was all part of your plan. But then in the second episode, he reveals that, like, what wasn't part of his plan was he assumed, I think, that the Emperor was going to execute him personally and then exile his followers to get rid of them. But what happened is that he got exiled with them, and we can already see that there is a weird blend of, like, over familiarity with the Wizard of Oz. Like, you know, people are no longer calling him Dr. Seldon. He's just Harry. But then some are kind of deifying him, saying he can do no wrong, putting ultimate stock in whatever he says. I'm guessing, because, you know, again, Harry, you know, I'll just say this. I'm guessing that Raish, you know, that they also, you know, we'll talk about him as his character in depth more. But I'm guessing that he murdered Harry as a way to, you know, move that bead back to the right side of the Abacus. I mean, for whatever reason, Harry thought that his weird variable in the equation was going to destabilize everything. So he had to be taken off the board. At least that's what my prediction is. Now, what they're doing with the escape pod at the end with Gale and all that stuff, I have no fucking clue. That was Harry dying in the second episode. I assumed he was going to die early in the season, but the second episode was kind of shocking. And also, yeah, the thing with what happened to Gale and Raish was pretty wild to me, too.
I didn't know that we'd ever see it. I don't recall, and I read this pretty recently, us ever seeing Harry die. We just kind of jump forward and we're on Terminus and the colony is set up and they're doing things. But I don't know that we ever see this part. So all this feels new and fresh to me. And you know, it's part of that more personal story, but it could be, like you said, also part of the larger story, right? This isn't necessarily a story of betrayal by one of his, you know, disgruntled acolytes. This could be all part of the Harry plan. And I think it's super interesting to see what happens if Harry has to go to those links to control the spin out of psychohistory, right? While he's alive. Well, he's kind of played that card. And how does he control psycho history going forward after his death? And I think that is going to be a fascinating part of this show if that's where they're taking it.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, like, there's always since we're talking about probabilities, we're not talking about certainties. We're talking about things being suboptimal or optimal. So, like, just because something's the optimal action doesn't mean you should do it now, because, like, as he mentioned, there's an optimal time to bring Gale to force the trial to do that. There's probably an optimal time for him to be dead, probably before the ship left. That doesn't mean all is lost. It just means, like, these are scales like this that are constantly shifting. And if one side gets unbalanced, that means you might have to put a little pebble on the other side to rebalance it. It's not more like, oh, fuck, this is not like a big, carefully orchestrated plan, step A, step B, step three. It's much more organic and, like I said, probability based than that. And I think that is coming through the show, and it's really exciting. I think that's going to be a lot of interesting things to look forward into the future episodes and seasons to see how that stuff, like you said, how do you, well, if you're dead and gone and you're the architect of all this, how do you make sure the people building the thing stay on the plan?
Right? When you're talking about time spans of 1,000 years, which is what he hoped to reduce this to, right? The chaos to. Yeah. I don't know. It's going to be fascinating. I think also maybe we should talk about psychohistory in its prediction, right? Because this is another thematic element of the show. And I think it's one that is super relevant today. When you're looking at climate change, you're looking at trusting science and mm-hmm. figuring out what the future is going to be before it happens and maybe averting the worst of it. Boy, we're living through that. And I can't help but think that the people writing the show know that. The people writing the show have that stuff in mind when they're creating this show. Because Psychohistory's prediction is that the Empire will fall. It doesn't say how it'll fall, right? But if you look at the Empire as our world, the Empire will crumble in 500 years, and there will be a period of 30,000 years of essentially dark ages, where everything will be terrible. There will be constant wars. Everyone will be scrounging for scraps. And then
10,000 worlds reduced to a cinder, you know, it's a horrific shit.
And Psychohistory, his aim with Psychohistory is not to avert that disaster because he says it's impossible, but to reduce the length of time that's true, the dark age, down to about 1,000 years. And I think that's kind of where we're at with climate change, right? We're not looking, we can't avert some of the things we're already seeing, like fires and droughts and floods and all mm-hmm. kinds of things, storms, but we do need to do what we can. We still have a chance to avert some of the worst of it. I think
right.
that's going to be big going forward, right?
Mm-hmm. I think so too. But again, it's a clear parallel between, I mean, they're explicitly making it, I think, in the case of Gale's planet.
Yes.
Where, you know, they had a bunch of people that their scientists tried to warn about the impending cataclysm that happened to their planet. And they were murdered for their temerity to tell people what they didn't want to hear. And then yet we clearly Gale's planet is
it happened.
yeah everything's underwater. Their fucking landing platforms are underwater. Everything's underwater.
Yeah, they're fucking Gungans now. I mean, yeah, it's like and yet the reaction of the society seems to have been to double down on that, and that's the infuriating thing to me. That but it feels so true to life, right? It's like, well, clearly everything you predicted was true and correct, and we were wrong for denying it, but we're not going to be wrong, so fuck you. We're just going to double down. That's the attitude I see in a lot of this stuff, and I don't know if they're how deep they're going to go on that stuff as we get closer to the fall of the Empire. I assume this show is going to span the 500 years, the 1,000 years, the 30,000 years, whatever.
Yeah.
If it gets to completion to season 8, as we get closer to the events actually unraveling the Empire. I do wonder what the reaction of the people will be to seeing that Selden's predictions were all accurate. Or yeah, maybe they won't be. I don't know, but
it's opposite of a lot of puzzle. Because this is kind of a puzzle box show. You know, a lot of puzzle box shows begin with like a crisis, and then you have to understand what caused the crisis and all that stuff. This yeah. is about like there is a crisis. We know it's going to happen. Are the heroes going to succeed not in diverting it, but into, like you said, lessening the impact and gentling the landing and shortening the period of pain? So it's a kind of an upside down approach to storytelling. So we can continue to talk about psychohistory, but I also want to talk about the solution, because that's like, you know, there's that great scene with Alexander Siddig where he's the advocate and he's got Harry Seldon on trial and, you know, okay, well, if this is the problem, then what is the solution? Are you just a prophet of doom? And he goes, no, we need to, you know, like Earth had a he refers back to essentially the Library of Alexandria. And he's like, we need to do that, only more decentralized. An Encyclopedia Galactica that gathers the sum total of all human knowledge, or at least everything that we can gather in the next few hundred years. And that will be the seed, the foundation, ta-da! The foundation from which the second galactic empire, presumably, or Pax Galactica, can kind of build upon. That you won't have people having to invent knowledge. It'll be all ready to go, and that can lead them out of the Dark Age faster. But there's this great scene in the second episode where the foundation, which seems largely pooled from the empire's best and brightest, are kind of myopic about lots of things, about like, well, what does that even mean? And mm-hmm. and we've seen that this is a lot, and we've come to appreciate in later day history that like our concept of history, when I say our, I talk about kind of like Western dominated history. I remember when I was taught history in school, it was always in relation to like how the world interacted with us. And again, when I say us, it's the West, you know, it wasn't like I didn't learn much about African civilizations. You know, we learned about the Age yeah. of Sail. And of course, that took place between the 14th and the 17th centuries. I mean, the Polynesians colonized literally all of the fucking Pacific Ocean thousands of years before. Where's the fuck? What? But the Age of Sail is the 300 years our Europeans were going around wooden boats doing shit. So right. that was the point of like, even from accounting as like, you know, base 10, you know, base 10 actually kind of sucks for a lot of reasons. Math, but we probably developed it because we have 10 fingers and it's easy to count mm-hmm. that way for humans. But base 12 is better for a lot of reasons. She brought up base 27, which is count. I don't know what fucking body parts you're counting for that. But
like hexadecimal yeah. in a lot of computer languages is 16.
Base 16,
yeah.
Which gives you even more divisors. So I thought that was a really interesting side point to be like, well, if we're collecting galactic history, whose point of view are we enshrining as the truth, and what knowledge are we missing by taking like this reverse provincial view at the universe? If we're only, you know, we're dedicating so much time to the core worlds and stuff, then like, what are we missing out? What are we skipping? I thought that was a great concept of a potential flaw. And maybe that was also one of the things that the beads in the back as to Harry was sliding around when he selected Gale. Although, again, he's probably just dealing with probabilities, too. Did he happen to find an exiled heretic, brilliant mathematician from a backwater world that would have kind of like these reverse prejudices against the Empire? Or did psychohistory guide him to that selection?
Yeah. Yeah, because I think he would admit that he couldn't have selected her individually, right?
Right, right. But maybe the thing he did was to try to find someone who would think outside the box that would use. Because yeah. I think that was the other thing is like, didn't she use a theorem that was pioneered by a female mathematician on kind of a backwater planet and wasn't very well regarded or read or not even many people knew about it?
Yeah, it was like called the Abraxas problem. I think
that's Abraxas, but she used some other theorem that was like the he gave her that like yes. the original scroll that had all those things in it. So like it was more of like
a poetic tome, but it also had embedded mathematics, and it was very controversial. Like nobody even yeah. read it because it was considered ludicrous, I guess.
Yeah, it seemed like he maybe was trying to, by devising this scheme, to get at someone that's outside the box, outside of like the core Empire worlds to you know, have that perspective. I thought that was really
also
cool.
That concept, like the idea that she solved this problem by using some strange theorem that nobody else would ever, that everybody else would laugh at, I think also cast doubt on the efficacy of psychohistory as well, right? Like mm-hmm. if your mathematical calculations rely on algorithms that most mathematicians disregard, mm-hmm. you have to be looked at as somewhat of a heretic, somewhat of a mm-hmm. charlatan, right? So like all that was feeding into the early sort of presentation of Harry Seldon as a guy who thinks he has the answers and acts very confidently as if he has the answers, but may be very wrong.
I also thought it was interesting because they make this point about, I think one of the emperors says that art is politics, but sweeter. This line between art and science, or art and the harder things, you know, Harry's, his mathematical equations are presented in a very beautiful way. Mm-hmm. Gale found this theorem in like this. She mentioned that this work was kind of like, she started reading it, is like this, almost like this very poetic way of saying, and very like non-mad, but like in the margins, if you read between the lines, you saw what she was saying suggested. So a lot yeah. of like mathematicians just disregard it because this is essentially hippy dippy bullshit. I thought that was really interesting too. Like some cultures communicate via art. Mm-hmm. I thought that, and even the, and it goes both ways. The Empire communicates through it. They had some reason they had the mural, right?
And it's really like the most core synthesis of what I could express Asimov's aspirations as when he wrote the Foundation series. As I understand it, Foundation is very much about the science and the politics coming together, right? The people and the numbers, the art and the science. A lot of the book is, it's very dry, but it's all very like politicky. If you look at it, it's all about the movement and the change of societies at large. And yes, you have psychohistory predicting that stuff, right? And the concrete mathematics you could point to and say things will probably happen this way because X, Y, Z. But then you have a lot of people exerting influence and their will in artful, political ways. And I think that is what Asimov is saying, is just as much as it's important to understand the science of things, it's also important to understand human nature. It's also important to understand the you know, flow and the movement and change of a society, which, man, I talk about the motifs in this show and how they're so strong. They do this with the mural, too. It's incredibly, incredibly well executed.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
I want to talk about the Empire, too, the personage of the Empire, the genetic dynasty, because I thought that was such a cool concept.
Yeah.
You know, clearly you've got It's such elegant. Like, you know, there's so many, and you think about so many stories in history of political instability, it's always when there's a transition. You know, you've got a revolution, or the old king dies and his son's a shit and all that kind of stuff. What if you could have, like, if everyone could agree that, hey, you know what, this one ruler is pretty good. What if you just kept having that one guy? You wouldn't have to worry about succession and all the things that can happen during a messy transfer of power and all that stuff. That's something we take for granted a lot in democracies that maybe the older democracies that, like, we have this thing where, like, we transition power from party to party, from person to person. Everything kind of goes smoothly, mostly. But I thought that was a great way to get around that. And the fact that you have, like, you decant these clones like a generation apart. And they refer to themselves as brothers, but they're not like, I never got the idea that they have like knowledge dumped into them. It's just like you have the same man who's essentially constantly mentoring themselves.
Yeah.
But they also did a good job of showing how they're not the same. Like there is a little bit drift. Yes. And the way that I thought that Hare made a point that was the death knell. That's the final thing when they started this cloning where there could never be change, where there could never be. Everything would be kind of calcified, and they make the point that hubris, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Brother Dusk was talking about, like imagine the hubris of thinking that not only are you going to be the first of a dynasty, but you will be the dynasty. You are the river from which everything else flows. Imagine thinking that much of yourself. And there's so many contradictions here because like Lee Pace's character, the current emperor, I guess the ruling emperor, Emperor Day, Brother Day. He tells his younger counterpart that the way the empire affects effective control is we pay attention to details and look at us notice like the filigree of this artifact was given of a gift is showing that they could double the imperial tithe, whereas this other shows that they are desperate for the metal and they might. But yet they treat these backwaters with such contempt and lack of seriousness. How can you possibly get the details right? You're talking about these people singing a song and you practice it, but you can't get it right because you don't have the nuances. Like you're too far away. And now that you're just a singular person, that you're too calcified and resistant to change. It's again, like it's not like they ever stopped the script and talk about this, but I thought it was really elegantly woven into the story, how that, you know, this dynasty has killed the ability for the empire to like reflexively respond to the concerns of the people.
There are a couple of scenes I'm going to mention a show here that's going to probably trigger some people. There are a couple of scenes in this show so far that are Game of Thrones-esque. And I'm talking about the really good Game of Thrones, the stuff where there is a lot of information under the surface of the words the characters are speaking. The turkey scene or whatever it is. He's carving the Christmas goose, right?
The peacock. And yeah.
Yeah, he does this probably for several reasons, but the thing that I took note of in this scene is how he reacts when the young brother Dawn says in what my opinion would be the correct answer to why it's a bad thing that the servants inject this thing with a needle instead of the knife, like the tradition would dictate. He says, they're too scared to do their jobs well, so you're guaranteeing they'll do their jobs poorly, and that's poor stewardship. And then if you look at the Emperor, he just essentially brushes that off. When I think that is the absolute correct answer here, you are creating a servant class that feels like you are a tyrant who will not be able to perform because of how afraid they are of you. And I think the fact that he doesn't even consider that is a consequence of like how calcified this whole empire situation is.
Yeah, I thought that scene was great because it had a couple things. First of all, you had the kid that misinterpreted a hunting song to be about a hunting song when it's literally like if you're older and wiser, you know, oh, this is about a guy losing his virginity, you know.
Yeah.
But yet in the second episode, the Emperor insists that because he heard this particular song, it had to mean this thing and had to be this certain thing. And there's no other interpretation for it. You know, and he had that thing is like, I'd like to hang. Someone's going to hang for this. I'd like it to be the right one. But like that's deliberate. That's out. That contradicts what the lesson he was trying to teach his younger brother. And also it's a warning, I think, on the Harry side that, like, if people are afraid to do their jobs right, then you're guaranteed they're going to do them wrong. Well, like, what is Harry doing by running all these teams through all these constant simulations where they're always coming up with failure?
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like there's literal damned if you do, damned if you don't. Well, if you let this beast attack, then your crew will be ripped up and you can't afford to replace those losses. But if you take the shot, you might blow a methane vein or something. Again, I thought that was really great how they use that stuff in a script to have so many different meanings.
And then they're using that generational gap between the emperors to, like, show both how naive children can be, right? But how that can also provide some clarity as well. Like, kid doesn't get that the song is about fucking, but also he doesn't, the brother Day doesn't understand that brother Don is actually totally right about his servant's mental status. So, like, exactly. There's a lot of back and forth for these generations. And then they're doing something even different with the older version, right? Where, like, he's sort of having a what is it all for kind of vibe, right? What are we doing here?
Yeah, it was as at the tail end of his life, which that's the thing I thought was, man, going back to the genetic lineage of this is like, has there ever been an old emperor that just doesn't want to pass on? Like, he's like, you got brother Day and he gets to be, you know, 45 and 50. He's looking gray and his pecs are starting to sag. And he's like, you know what? I don't think brother Don's ready for it. I don't think so. Like, has there ever been, like, and maybe they'll play with that idea. I think that would be kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this show does so much great work at, because even going back to that psycho history stuff where you're talking about, you know, the importance of people. They make that point so many times, like the math is important. But as Harry said, without the people, you can't, they both need each other because the math without the people has no, like, agency, essentially.
Right.
And the people without the math are just unreasoning, kind of like beasts trampling around causing chaos. Mm-hmm. So you have to have both of those things kind of in harmony. You have to count for both things. You can't just be a number cruncher. And that's the question I have, is like, losing Harry, it's like he seems like almost uniquely suited to play both of those roles. And like, if you lose him this early into the project, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah. Very good question. Probably my favorite scene in the whole thing. I don't know how conceptually this ties into the themes, but my favorite scene is the scene where Brother Day has brought the two leaders of Thespis and Anacreon to the Scar, right? And they're in this, like, burned out husk of what looks almost like a gladiatorial arena. And he's putting people involved that he assumes are involved in the conspiracy to destroy the space elevator, the Star Bridge, to death. And he's hanging them. And you can see the crowds around, right? He doesn't do this in the Imperial Palace. He takes this out to people to demonstrate his strength. And I think that was, it was both intellectually interesting and also just an excellently composed scene. I couldn't help but, you know, feel like, oh my God, this is going to dark places when he's pushing people off of that second, third story, whatever, to their deaths and hanging them. And the crowd is erupting in cheers, right? I think of some of the moments that, like, we've had in our past where, it, you know, people have done things to us. Recently we commemorated a 20th anniversary of one of those for 9/11. And you know that people want some kind of vengeance here and they don't necessarily care who it's targeted at. And that's a very scary thing. And I got all of that emotion and that danger out of this scene.
There's also a thing about the human spirit. I've read that, like, humans are predisposed, and like, we are very bad at risk analysis because we tend to overvalue the reward and we minimize the risk. Some of us are wired the other way, but like, that's why we're explorers, you know, because all we see, oh, the discovery, oh, the new worlds we're going to see. We don't see burning up on atmosphere. We don't see our ship breaking in a rogue wave and drowning, right? That's, you know, that's. And you can see, like, in this arc full of true committed believers, that you have people taking crazy risks because of the idea that, like, okay, well, okay, maybe it'd be better to wait to have a baby when we make Planet, because it was almost comical the way the lady was like, oh, I know about the radiation, I know about the birth defects, I know about my poison milk. But what if I never make it to the planet? Or what if we make it to the planet and it's even worse? Like, these true believers cannot truly commit to what they think is the better way to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that says something interesting about, and that'll be a constant tension too, the idea that the things we're doing, like, what's that old proverb that, like, the society will prosper when old men plant the trees of shade to which they'll never be able to feel?
Mm. Yeah.
Like, the concept that everything you're doing in your life is going to benefit people that are living hundreds of years after you're dead.
Yeah.
And in fact, you're going through tons and tons of short hardships. And even people that are taking that deal are, like, trying to find their own little shortcuts to it.
And here's what I love. First generation, yeah. You memorialize, right? You're like, oh, fuck yeah, these are the people that came over on the boats, the pilgrims, baby. Second, yep. Third, fifth, 20th generations don't get shit. They just get shit on. Like,
yeah.
They don't ever see the end of this thing. There are going to be generations that don't see this. I'm curious, once we get past that first generation that might have an incentive to get their name on some plaque somewhere at Terminus. What do those people look like? What do those people think and do?
That is fast. It's like, anytime I think of colony ships, you know, the idea of, like, sending a ship in space, it's going to take 1,000 years to get to a star, but you're going to have generations of people living and born. Like, the people that launched that ship, that's a big fucking deal. The people that land on the extraterrestrial planet. But what about the generations between?
Yeah.
You're literally just suspended animation with extra steps.
Yeah.
Your entire life is a cryo tank for your genetic material to pass on, eventually colonize this thing. Like, I almost think that a colony ship would never work, because, like, it would fall to chaos and rebellion because of people realizing the pointlessness of their immediate lives. Or I don't know, maybe you could, like, make some kind of, like, shipboard religion that you can induce in people. But either way, you either have to engage in mass deception, lying, or coercion. Or you face, like, you know, chaos.
Or zealotry. I mean, you have to have a pretty tight grip on people's emotions.
And we already have, like, suicide bombers. So that's, like, you know, one of the heights of zealotry. Right. So it's clearly those themes of religious fanaticism versus, like, cold empiricism in conflict. Those are going, because that's in conflict even in Harry's crew, his handpicked crew.
Yeah.
What, much less the 8 trillion people that's living in the galaxy. Okay, Jim, I want to talk about the main characters as far as the ones I can tell from the series. And then we'll talk about some book versus show differences. If people want to check out for that, they can. But first up, one of the clearly important roles that we just don't know much about right now is this Warden Salver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know, like, she's some sort of authority figure that is watching over the foundation on Terminus. This happens 35 years past all the rest of the plot of the episodes, you know, all the stuff you see with Harry and Gale and all that stuff. And she's got something special to her that allows her to resist the null field of this vault object. Because, like, as Gale's narration informs us, like, you know, Harry's psychohistory does great on large scales, large swaths of humanity, but it doesn't predict individuals.
Yeah.
What is the effect of an individual who can breach this vault breach this null effect and get to the vault?
We don't know what's causing it. I mean, we don't even know what the vault is. It seems like some alien presence in the way that it's sort of depicted here. Is this, like, some kind of mutation that she has that, Harry couldn't have foreseen? What's in the vault? They call whatever is in there a ghost. I don't know exactly what they think is in there, but that sounds interesting.
It could just be her, though. She said that the ghost people see is her. But clearly she's going to be involved in some kind of, like, either monkey wrench or linchpin of Harry Seldon's plan. And we don't know much about her other than she's got a really cool suit of body armor. I was wondering, like, if, is that what allows her to resist a field? There's just so many mysteries and questions about her that I don't know. She's got a lot of question marks, but she's definitely going to be a central figure moving forward. Mm-hmm. And then there's, of course, Gale. I thought she was interesting. She's not just from a backwater, but she's from this fundamentalist religious cult.
Yeah.
And she was going to be one of the priests of her society, had those seeing stones and embedded into her cheeks. And at some point I don't know that she chose to get that done to her, or they were stripped from her. And the way Harry talks is she was about to be either imprisoned or executed because of the heresy of being curious, trying to warn people about the impending climate change disaster. And now she's a heretic. She's an outsider.
My impression was that she was about to potentially be executed because she had solved the Abraxas equation or problem or whatever, and they had found out about that. Which,
yeah,
because I think the climate crisis happened way before her.
You're
time.
Right, but isn't that? But she also said, like, you know, when she was maybe she's talking in general terms in a trial, because she said, I thought she had mentioned something about wanting to save her people. That's why she got into that. But then she also said she got into it because she's lonely and was reading a bunch. And
maybe and I'm not sure the exact history of her.
Yeah, she's brilliant at math. It felt like almost intuitively so. Like, she wasn't formally educated in all this stuff. She just is a big reader and she's got a knack for it. And she can, like, in the same way Harry can, kind of grasp these big picture things in a way that few others can.
On her planet, she couldn't really have any formal training.
She's also special in some way. I wonder, is she special in, like, the same way that Salver is? That she has some kind of mutation or gift or ability? We see that she was able to regain consciousness during hyperspace jump, which is supposed to be impossible. And we also are told by another character that it can change your perception. Like, it sends your body and mind on different trips. So what the fuck
I'm
does
looking
that mean?
For the fallout from that. Like, where does that intersect with what we're seeing here?
Yeah.
Make her, like, crazy, and now she's backing everything that Selden says, even though that's crazy? Like, there's a lot of question marks around Selden and his psychohistory, even though you've got an outsider coming in and confirming it, right? Because she herself is a big question mark.
Mm-hmm. You also have the relationship she has with Raish. Raish is, I got the idea that he is kind of like an adopted son to Harry. That from Harry's perspective, he took him in a bad space, from which wasn't literally true. Because the way he told it, like, he grew up poor. His mom died. His father was injured in an industrial accident, and he was stealing books, but he's stealing books to get his father's treatment, where Harry got it all backwards. He's like, oh, your mom died and your dad is drinking himself to death, and I caught you stealing books and I took you in. I wonder if there's anything important in that this distinction.
It's like every mob movie you've ever seen, right? Where the mobster comes around and befriends the kid, you know, flips him a quarter and says, here, kid, buy yourself some candy. And then 25 years later, he's got him on the payroll.
Right. There's a lot of Martin Scorsese movies that start that way anyway.
Yes.
But he's something of a son. Like, he refers to him as such early in the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets this kind of intense, infatuated young person relationship with Gale. They both do. Also, we mentioned that Gale got pregnant this episode and then had her zygote removed for the seed bank.
Yeah.
That was interesting. I thought that in the first episode, when I was just watching, just without taking notes or anything, or the first time I watched it, I thought they're just harvesting eggs. Like, that's something did to, like, every once in a while, they just, like, get all the women in there, harvest eggs to make sure the radiation doesn't fuck with them. And then they got good, clean genetic material to work with on the land planet side. But no, apparently they're only doing that. No need for birth control. They can just harvest the babies right out of your uterus and put them in the cryo freeze.
Maybe they do both. It'd be smart to do both, right? Get the eggs, get the sperm and stuff before it's been irradiated by, you know, a massive sublight travel. I guess it's faster than light, but yeah. Get it early before it's been irradiated.
And then you got Harry Seldon, which is kind of the most Jesus Christ. mysterious figure in the show. I just Porky Pigged it. You're right. Because he has a lot of dialogue and he talks a lot, but like he never talks about his interior thoughts or feelings. Like I think it's clear to me that he loves Raish. It's clear to me that he respects and admires Gale. I think he's a benevolent figure and that he is one of those few who will take the long view of things and take the risks necessary to save people he'll never meet, Torment. But like, we don't really know what his hopes and fears and dreams are. We see, you know, there's scenes of Jared Harris fretting in his office, looking at his calculations and putting his hands in his head, you know, and like sweating all the details. But we don't really know about it. Now that his shocking death has happened, I'm not sure, you know, how else we're going to get to know him. But I don't know what else we know about this guy.
My guess as to his inner turmoil is whether or not he's right about this stuff. I think he projects a very self-assured sort of belief in psychohistory, but privately, maybe he worries that his predictions are not as strong as he makes them sound, or perhaps that, you know, if he sees himself eventually being killed by the Emperor or somebody, that once he's gone, he's not sure he can maintain the course. And that psychohistory will sort of drift.
So the three of these have an interesting relationship in that, they introduce Raish's knives. You know, they go, Gale wants to go to a seer temple. And apparently you can't bring weapons in there. So he has to disarm his knives. He got this wicked looking hunting knives. And he uses the same knives to kill, like, to gut Harry Seldon. And then he takes Gale and he drags her into this escape pod and throws the murder weapon at her feet and then fills it full of fluid and injects her into deep space. This is one of the ones I thought this was like maybe a weakness I saw in the episode, because like my understanding of this is essentially a Dumbledore Snape play. And I know that doesn't mean anything to you because it's Harry Potter, but it literally means that everyone else on the planet knows what I'm talking about.
Oh, sure.
That you've got a guy who is going to die. And I say that because there's a knowing glance between Raish and Harry at the dinner table where like Harry looks significantly at this box of pills that he's taking a pill for. I'm gathering, and again, this is not book knowledge because this does not happen in the book, but I'm guessing that Harry is dying for some reason anyway. One of the reasons that maybe he engineered or steered the destiny to where he would die as a martyr. But like I was wondering if Raish killed, like, what does that accomplish? To kill Harry and then take his chief acolyte, put the murder weapon in her pod and eject her into space. Like, what is the purpose of that? Does that serve? Do you have any ideas or any speculation?
I mean, my initial thought when I was watching it is that he's getting rid of the murder weapon. You know, like he's going to send her out into space and he doesn't want the murder weapon on him because then people know he did it. But if you say there are knowing glances and then maybe this whole scene at the dinner table or whatever is manufactured, maybe Seldon does in fact know exactly what he was doing with the books and stealing them, but he created this so that, you know, they could act like there was some scuffle and then maybe Raish could take a fall. Maybe that's part of the plan. But if that's the case, he would want the murder weapon, right? He would want it to be on him. So I don't know. I'm confused by all this because, like you said, it's not in the books and it came out of nowhere for me. It just surprised the hell out of me.
Well, the only thing I can guess is there's another hint where Brother Day says, you know, Harry Seldon is not beyond our reach. We could kill him and we could blame the other side and we could say it until it's in the air that we breathe and all that kind of stuff. And it seems like he's dissuaded from the act because, like, I think maybe there I think there is something pitched at one element of the audience. It's like, hey, this is exactly what's happened. The Emperor's just decided to use a cat's paw, and it's Raish, and he's angry at his adopted dad for killing making his real dad drink himself to death, and he's doing this. But I don't like that interpretation. I like the Dumbledore Snape one better, which is essentially maybe Harry wanted the Emperor to do that, to martyr him, and the Emperor refusing to do it. They're going to do a reverse plan where Raish is going to say that Gale murdered Harry, and he was shocked and horrified and knew that the ship would tear her apart. So he loaded her in an escape pod and got her off there so they couldn't hurt her. And that she's going to go back to, I'm guessing, the core of the Empire. And while she's making that trip, this ship is going to report a broadcast that she's murdered Harry. And that's something that the Emperor is going to be pleased with. And it's going to allow mm-hmm. her to curry favor with the Emperor. To what end? Because, again, that's correct me if I'm wrong, but that's a wild deviation from the plot of the book.
Huge. And I've only read the first book, so maybe this is in, you know, one of the sequels or something, and they fill this mm-hmm. in more. But I don't know anything about Harry's death, although
yeah,
it takes place over a large span of time, that first book. So he's definitely dead. It's just how that happened. I don't think I knew. Just why
there's something
me.
Special about her also being able to be awake during jumps. Like, are they going to literally, you're going to see the next episode that she sent through a wormhole. Like there's an actual naturally occurring one that Harry knows in this region. It's because, like, that's the thing. It's like, you know, Harry is like the ultimate kind of like, oh, you foresaw this. Well, I foresaw that you foresaw it. And I, because of that, and I foresaw that you foresaw that I would foresee that. And yeah. So he's got all these like plans within plans within plans. I wonder if they're going to do some freestyling in the show to kind of like really show those multiple layers. And that's going to be one of them. But again, I'm trying to figure out like, okay, Gale is special. She can stay away from hyperspace jumps, which allows her to travel long distance in a safe way that's apparently impossible from other humans, or at least baseline humans.
Yeah. So I have a lot of wild theories, because like I said, none of this happens in the book. I've got a crazy theory that says Harry Seldon arranged for the space elevator to be blown up. You know, this could be one of the predictive sort of events that he needs to happen, and this will exceed or, you know, speed up the downfall of the Empire. And there's a quote that you were talking to me about before this episode where I think it's Gale is talking about characters that they'll see or people that yeah, we'll come across. And one
the
of them
story
was
of humanity. Yeah.
And there were
the
four things listed, right? One of them was murderer, martyr, mathematician, Harry Seldon.
Yeah.
And thinking back now, if that's the case, if he, and this is like kind of why I maybe think that he is a mathematician, certainly.
Sure.
He has become a martyr. If he's trying to blame, you know, this Empire on his death, he is definitely Harry Seldon, that we know.
I mean, he's a martyr no matter what. He's a believer in a cause and he was murdered.
True. Whether it's by the Empire or some rogue agent within his organization. Yes. And he definitely is Harry Seldon. So the only thing he hasn't proved to
yes,
be yet.
That does check out that last fact. Yeah.
Is a murderer. But what if he orchestrated the bombing of this space elevator? That would make him a mass murderer.
Yeah, and it changes how I feel about him. But on the other hand, when you're talking about like 8 billion, you know, what is 100 million people against 8 trillion?
And he's talking about 29,000 years of dark ages, averting all of that.
Yeah.
Massive
wars. Not just
8
trillion
famine.
Current citizens, but all the ones that'll be born in or not born into the future because of that. It's like, yeah, like, it's horrifying calculus, but he is a mathematician, as you said.
Right.
So that's one interpretation that like Harry is all those things. But like strictly speaking, what she said is there are roles that loom larger in history than others. And here are some of the bigger. And you have a mathematician, a martyr, a murderer, and then Harry Seldon. Mm-hmm. If we try to say that, OK, well, those aren't all the same because she's literally said you've got, you know, a sailor, a soldier, a baker, and then this other guy. Probably you wouldn't say that those are all the same thing. If we tried to look at
unless
like,
they're Steven Seagal
other...
in Under Siege, and then they definitely are.
Or Gary Oldman in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, because yes. he was all no. But yeah, like if you're a mathematician, obviously is Gale. If you eliminate Harry from that, a murderer, obviously Raish. Mm-hmm. I think. I mean, you could also say the Emperor, I guess. But like Raish seems to be the one singular character committing a murder, not an execution. You got Harry Seldon, who is uncontroversially Harry Seldon.
Right.
But then you got the martyr. And I'm not sure if in this circumstance, I'm not sure if this is the correct understanding. I don't think the martyr has been identified yet, because I don't think that she says a martyr, not like, because you got the two guys that martyred themselves to take out the Starbridge. Mm. But I can't think of anybody else. I think the martyr, so I guess we need to twin track these theories. Like, keep in mind that maybe it's all Harry Seldon. They're doing a little Obi-Wan Kenobi fudging of words. Mm-hmm. Or we've got a scenario where we're still trying to identify. We got some pretty strong leads on the martyr or the murderer and mathematician angle. But if Harry Seldon can't be the martyr, then there must be some other martyr. Yeah. And we're going to be looking for them.
There's one other aspect of Harry's death that I want to talk about that struck me.
Okay.
And it's the alarm on the ship that's monitoring his vital functions and says, Harry Seldon's life functions have ceased. And it's flashing
light. Plot advancement alert. Danger, Will Robinson. The plot has advanced. Yeah.
That struck me as strange, right? Because it is cheesy and weird and dumb for a series like this that has been so amazing in its crafting. I don't understand. Is this some like, it makes me think it's part of the plan, right? Why would Harry Seldon have rigged an alarm on his ship to let the crew know when he dies? Unless that was very, very important.
I want to say it because it's contrasted with the other final scene from the Emperor's perspective where he's doing this big theatrical execution at the Scar, right? Uh-huh. Is it just theatrics? Is it literally just to make sure everyone's aware? Because you see the head of the foundation project being like, what's going on? And he sees this guy covered in blood and he sees her and this guy's like, is it just to sell the story that she and we're taking her off to so like Raish is going to be the one that takes the fall for this from the colony's perspective because he's the one that martyrs Harry Seldon. But she's going to be in chrono sleep or whatever and can't correct the story until a year. I don't know. Because that's the only thing I can think of. It's literally theatrics. Like Harry wanted it this way so that when it happened, no one could fail to take notice. It's one of those big variables that he wanted to make sure his target population of probability people noticed.
Yeah. I don't think this will like set off a second phase of foundation because everyone has to be in on it, right? And then what does it mean to martyr yourself when everyone is in on the plan of you being martyred? It's like,
right.
Was Raish the only one not told that his death would kick off the second phase of this thing? Yeah. So I don't know. You're probably right. It's probably just theatrics, but it struck me as strange.
We covered this quite a bit in other parts of the podcast, but the Emperor, the genetic dynasty, brothers Dusk, Dawn, and Day. Is there anything that we want to cover there?
Man, the casting is so good. The old brother Dusk looks exactly like an old Lee Pace.
He really does. He's even got the hair slicked back, the kind of like the nose. Like it is a very, very good light. I'm not sure about the kid, but then, you know, I don't know. Who can tell
with kids, yeah.
Right. And I'm sure that they'll advance the ages of these roles as we go forward. But the casting is extraordinary. I think they're doing a good job of portraying these guys as like seemingly benevolent, you know, like the majority of the people kind of like support the Emperor's peace and respect it. And, you know, they've been doing it for 400 years. So bully on them. I like some of the specific things like that hand gesture they're always using, which reminds me a lot of like, you know, you see a picture of Jesus with when he's making this sign, it's like the sign of a blessing or something. And it's, I was always taught that in the Catholic religions and some of the Eastern Orthodox religions, that sign represents the Trinity because you're holding up three fingers, including your two fingers and your thumb. But also the two fingers represents the dual nature of Christ as divine and human. And I thought that they were deliberately evoking that, kind of like this god emperor type and the fact that they are a triune, literally a trinity of ruling bodies. One has the head and is currently the one that's in charge, but the others have powers and abilities of their own. Like, for example, when Brother Day tried to shut down the Brother Dusk from meeting with the ambassadors, he's like, "That's not your job." He goes, "No, but it is my right. Like, yeah. You know, I have a job to oversee." And I wonder if they'll also get into, because I alluded to, like, what has there ever been a Brother Day that doesn't want to become a Brother Dusk and just wants to keep living, you know, or prolong his natural life or disrupt this? Like, what is the mechanism that keeps that in place? And I'm very interested because Brother Dusk seems to be declining. Like, Lee Pace's character notices it. We see him fall off his ladder. His hands are shaking. I think he himself realizes that he's coming to the end. I wonder what that looks like. You know, what is the process of, you know, one, what is the process of them advancing? Do they have to all advance at the same time? What would happen if, like, Brother Dusk was assassinated, you know, or for that matter, Brother Day was assassinated? Like, how would they make up? Maybe they're just impervious to harm with those collars. I don't know. But I thought those things are really cool to kind of speculate about.
Yeah, you wonder what would have happened if the space elevator had landed perhaps on the Imperial Palace.
Right.
Would the collars have protected them from something like that?
Right.
Who knows?
Well, because it's, yeah, when like his assistant, which we're going to talk about here in a minute, Demerzel, seemed really concerned when he took off, when he deactivated his collar, like now he could actually take physical damage. But yeah, the whole fucking scar just collapsed on him. Is he just in a stasis field in a bottle of rum? Like, we'll dig him out in 100 years or whatever. But right. I don't know. I also wonder if there are limits to that personal protection too. Like, you know, that's proof of against assassination, but like, what can it save you from? Like an atomic bomb? Someone drops a black hole on you? The vacuum of space? Like what?
Yeah, good questions. Maybe we'll see more.
Well, like I said, they did a good job of showing the benevolence or the seeming benevolence of the character, but also like the underbelly of what this piece is maintained. Like they evaporate, they disintegrate a long-term retainer to the family, the guy that maintains the mural that the other guys have done just for having a Harry Seldon tracked in his quarters.
Yeah.
We see all the shrouding, the just indiscriminate shrouding, which looks like a traumatic process.
Their presentation Brother Day, of strength is to destroy a good portion of the two planets that may or may not have had something to do with the space elevator destruction.
Right. And whether they did or not, whether it was the act of a few lone madmen or like a coordinated effort by the government. All the people on that planet weren't part of that.
Right.
And the punishment was indiscriminate. So and it's also telling that like when Brother Dawn, you know, said like, will all the days be like, she's like, oh, no, you don't have to always make these difficult decisions. And it's like, when we have these difficult decisions, do we always choose this? And she says, yes. So like Brother Dusk says, don't overthink the stick too much. It seems like the Emperor's like, you know, there's a way that you can look at that. It's like, you know, we got 8 trillion people to take care of. If we wipe out 100 million people on a planet to save that peace, and really who cares? It's a rounding error.
Mm-hmm.
But they're really good. Like I said, Lee Pace just gives that sense of gravitas in the same way that like, you know, Jared Harris can portray, you know, do that laundry room scene where he just like inspires the whole room. It's just so well casted. And then I want to talk about Demerzel.
Okay.
So I think we talked about this in the preview podcast, but like there was a lot of speculation that she was going to be a robot. Robots were not in, you know, even though Asimov is synonymous with the concept of robotics, the laws of robotics, he did a whole series based on like, you know, advanced artificial intelligence and how they'd interact with humans and all that kind of stuff. He never in a Foundation series. I thought it's interesting that they found the way to like bring this character who is a big part of because one of the things Asimov did later in his life was try to unify all of his works into this grand kind of story, like, you know, the Foundation and Empire and robot series didn't really have much to do with each other. But then he wrote some prequels and stuff that kind of like showed, oh, no, these are all in the same universe and they're all connected. And this Demerzel character, who she even hints has lived a long time. Like, she's like, you know, I'll, you know, she promises brother Dawn, I'll be there for you the way I always have been and I always will be, because she's a robot. She's never going to age. I was actually shocked that they reveal her true nature in the, like, what's the second episode?
Yeah, especially after they mention, you know, robot wars and AI sympathizers and all this kind of stuff. You're thinking, well, surely the Empire wouldn't risk having robots after all of that. And I thought maybe that they were doing some robot stuff with the Starbridge attendees, let's say, the people who sort of stay awake
They call them spacers.
Yeah, but you pointed out that maybe they're just modified humans, which would make more sense because the robotic nature of Demerzel seems to be pretty hidden from everyone except for the emperors themselves. So, yeah, maybe those are modified humans and not robots.
Because that's the thing, is like, I think you're supposed to understand in this universe that they had a robotic war. And as a result of that, that just like it happens in Frank Herbert's Dune.
Picard.
You had this. Sarah Connor Chronicles. The robots go berserk. You got to wipe them out before they wipe us out. The organic beings came out on top in this universe and they've all been stomped out of existence. Demerzel says as much to Brother Day. It's like, you know, we didn't die. Your kind destroyed us. And there's a difference to that. I felt like there's a bunch of glances and scenes where it felt like, you know, that was like the way she gave that line reading, like, no, we didn't die. We were destroyed by your kind. And then she kind of like that voice dripped into a little bit of menace and then went instantly back to like the matronly role of, you know, kind of like mothering this child. Do you think there's any significance to that? Because also it's I'm thinking, you know, she said when they're talking in the apple orchard about there being an imperial garden that has an apple orchard, it's older than the robot wars. That's where they used to hang AI sympathizers. And she said people were sympathetic to the robots. There's always a sympathizer. I wonder if she is got her own goal. Like, what is her long plan?
Yeah.
Why does the Empire trust her? This devious AI construct.
She spends a lot of time with Brother Dawn, mentoring him, right? How much does she mold the actual Emperor? How much is she the power behind the curtain that really runs the Empire, right? You think so this is a bit redundant because of the cloning idea, but in this context, there are several, let's say, generational powers here, right? There's the Empire, which is supported by cloning, and the Emperor himself is a generational power. There's robots who live for generation after generation, so individually they can be generational. And then there's the Foundation itself, which is meant to be this generation spanning preservation project. And like I said, I think it's a bit redundant to have like the robot inside the Empire and both of those things being sort of an individual that is generational. There's some slight nuance there because, you know, it's not actually truly the individual in the Emperor's case, but it is as close as a human form can get to it. So like,
yeah,
I don't know. I'm interested to see what they do with those forces going forward.
I mean, from a storytelling standpoint, it is nice to have, like, if your protagonists are going to change by necessity, because it seems like that's one of the things that Harry is different. He's like, you know, the Brother Day said, surely you can see the value of having a younger, your own mind in a younger body. And he's comparing him to what he's doing to Gale, like, you know, making her his acolyte. And he's like, yeah, but there's a difference. And that is the difference. I value the differences. I don't want a carbon copy of me. I want. So they're the heroes who are going to have a succession of different, I guess, you know, people that they're handing the torch, the baton to, versus the antagonist, perhaps the robot lady and the emperors, who were always going to have Lee Pace playing, you know, 10, 15 years older, maybe 10, 15 years younger than him. We're always going to have Brother Dusk, same thing. We're always going to have either a little kid or a teenage version Dawn. Like having a consistent protagonist that you can identify with is maybe one thing that they're making as a sop to storytelling. Just like, hey, you know, the protagonist is going to shift like sands of grain in these fucking paintings, but the villains will always be clear and consistent and easy to identify.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. Can I ask you a sort of meta question? What if they do if this show goes for 8 seasons and spends like 10 years in production with Brother Dawn? because the actual kid who's playing Brother Don right now will age mm-hmm. into a teenage version of himself, the real life kid. But then do you, and the kid who apparently there's going to be a teenage Brother Don.
I saw that in some of the preseason and stuff. Yeah.
Who plays him as a teenager will age out of that role. Do you then replace him with the younger kid who grew up, you know, in season 8 or whatever we're doing? Or I don't even know if the Empire will be around in season 8, but.
Well,
that
I mean,
is an interesting sort of dynamic with ages of actors and ages of clones.
With the time jump that we're dealing with, we already had like a time jump back and forth 35 years. With those kind of time jumps, you could like have a person be 5 or 10 years older and still playing the same person. And also, since they're clones, you can kind of fudge that a little bit to where.
Oh, that works with like Lee Pace and the old guy, but not with the kid.
Not the young guy, but like maybe the young guy, you're always going to be a version of like they're going to jump to. I don't know. I don't have a good. I guess like with the cloning, they can fudge it with like the young guy's just slightly different versions of himself. But
or, you know, that's one of the reasons they casted. They need a new.
I don't think the young kid looks like a very plausible young Lee Pace either. So like maybe that's why they kind of zigged with that casting, so they can, you know, you're not. But I don't know. I guess I'm expecting when they get a teenage Emperor Day that he's going, or Emperor Dawn, he's going to look more of like a plausible.
I think he does. Pace,
but who knows. But the other thing about Demerzel is she wants to be human. She's got like a Lieutenant Commander Data arc, but that might be a survival camouflage more than an aspiration, because she's like, what's that line she says? It's dangerous to try to like inhabit two different realities at the same time. It's confusing to commit to more than one reality.
Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting line that might bear further fruit. The final character, and I don't. Well, I guess there's two characters. One is the Seer. Mm-hmm. I don't know much about him. So he's the only priest of this obscure religion from the planet that Gale is along. Synod or something.
Synax.
That's there. You got it. He's the only one allowed on Trantor. Clearly hates the Empire and probably all technology and all that kind of stuff. But he seems to be playing double sides, because he reaffirmed when Gale goes to see him, he reaffirms her status as heretic and damned and unseen by God, but also offers her safety and refuge. But then when the Emperor comes and asks her, like, does she have the gift? Was she a genuine seer? He says she sees nothing, but then nevertheless reaffirms her correction as predicted, or her prediction correct. And they're like, yeah, the Empire is going to burn.
Mm-hmm.
So what is this guy's whole deal, man? I wonder if he's going to be I wouldn't even say he's going to be a main character, except for he's very conspicuously part of the very first two episodes. He's at Harry's trial. He advises Gale. The Emperor seeks him out. I wonder where that's going.
I think, you know, I wouldn't necessarily think without him that that Gale was on her way back to Tenant, what the fuck is the name of this planet?
Terminus or Trantor?
Trantor, thank you. That she was on the way back to Trantor, but with how conspicuous he is in the first episodes and how much tension there would be between him and her, if she were to go back, I think you might be right about that's where she's headed, back to Trantor to reconnect with the Seer.
So we
already
know there's already someone to offer her like refuge and but I don't know. Yeah. Like, also, how much power do these priests have on the planet? Because like they can boss around the fucking Emperor Dusk anyway.
Yeah.
The other character that I'm looking for, that it's not even a character, is Clark Peters, who Bald Move fans might recognize as Lester Freeman from The Wire. Like, this guy doesn't even have a speaking line. Maybe he says one sentence and the camera cuts him laughing. Like, he's going to be a significant figure. You don't bring Clark Peters into a television production if you're just going to have him laugh at a joke and say pass the table salt, please.
Also, you don't darken his beard and hair either if he's not going to be around for a little while, right?
I do know that famously, black don't crack, but The Wire did take place 20 fucking years ago, and the man does not seem to have aged. He was like in his mid 50s there, and he's just stayed at that level.
No, if you look at him like in real life, he does have a few gray hairs for sure. His beard is maybe a little grayer, but clearly like darkened his beard and his hair. So that tells me that they're eventually going to get to his natural state, and it'll be maybe the 35 years later or whatever.
Or yeah.
Yeah. And he will be a bigger part of the show, I'm sure.
I'm wondering how they do, because I thought the way they did the time jumps was just great. You know, you've got the initial hook to kind of set the mystery, and kind of reminded me how Game of Thrones began, you know, like this, like a central mystery of what is the field, what is the vault, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, it goes back to the main storyline. That's 35 years before. Like, but we want to know what comes in between. I want to know what happens to Gale. I want to know what happens to Raish. I want to know what happens, like what I want to see the founding of Terminus and their struggles and how they set up the foundation and get the Galactic Encyclopedia Galactica going and all that stuff. I hope they have a good way to handle all that, because I'll be a little dissatisfied because that's the one thing that really threw me in the, because I, you know, I had this Alan Sepinwall saying this is a overall mediocre show in the back of my mind. When we got to the second episode and they were like fucking in the pool, and then we just jumped to her on the planet colonizing.
Yeah.
And I was literally like, what the, this is not a great way to tell a story, David. I see what Alan's, and then it was a danger room simulator. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yes. This makes a lot of sense. I don't think you can do that. It really throws people. You got to have a way to throw the plot in a direction and a velocity that people can like catch it on the other side. If otherwise they're going to drop the ball and not give a fuck.
Yeah. We talk about David Simon's stuff a lot of the time in regards to this, especially like the Deuce, right? Where he'll jump ahead a bunch of years or a year. Yeah. I don't know. He sets the ball in motion and then you pick
seasons,
it up when you come back.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a good time to transition over to book and show differences, at least for that first book of Foundation, which I read, because the vault is an example of that.
Let's give people a chance to stop the podcast if they don't want to listen at this point, or pause the it, because we are going to again talk about difference in the book. I don't know if it'll be heavy spoilers, but again, if you haven't read the books, you're probably not interested in this, so fuck off.
Sure.
We'll be back next week.
Here's the thing. I can't be sympathetic to spoiling books that are almost 100 years old at this point.
Yeah. Right,
however, I can be sympathetic to using book knowledge to potentially ruin a show that people haven't seen yet and it hasn't been made yet. So I'm going to try and whenever we talk about these kind of spoilers, we'll demarcate it.
And if this is where bounce, I just want to let you know, foundation@baldmove.com is where you send in feedback, which we'll start taking next week. Because this was a supersized episode. I don't want to blow it up even further. So foundation@baldmove.com. If you don't care about the books, this is where I'll say goodbye. And we'll see you next week for episode 3. By the way, if you I know some people don't like our more thematic kind of like character, whatever based, they like our scene by scene recaps. We're going back to that next week. We just don't want to do it this way because two scene by scene things. Yeah. And it's just going to be a mess. So next week we'll start the scene by scene breakdown and analysis thrown in. All right.
The vault. The vault is very much a known quantity in the book.
I recalled it being such. Yes.
And it's not. So I like the framework here. I like the framing device for episode 1 is this vault and like the strange planet, right? We know that they're going to Terminus, I think, at the end of the first episode, and the Terminus is the place where this vault is. And that one of these characters kind of like, I think it's Gale, is narrating this thing and saying like she didn't know about the vault and all that stuff or any of these names. So it's a framing device and it works well to add a lot of intrigue and mystery to the show. You don't know if you're dealing with an alien presence. You don't know if this is like something that the Empire uses for control of these systems out of nowhere or what. In the book, it's a lot less cryptic, right? It's like, the ghost that they're talking about inside of the vault is Harry Seldon. It's just like an image of Harry Seldon, which, you know, when you talk about like Salvor Hardin being sort of the ghost or describing herself as the ghost in the machine here, are they going to change it? Are they going to make her be sort of in these vaults instead of Harry?
I was being sneaky because I was trying to misdirect the fact that, like, I think the ghost in the vault is exactly that. It's Harry Seldon. And okay. Because that's the thing, like they
didn't know if you picked
this,
up on something else that I had.
No, I just didn't want to get too much into like, oh yeah, the ghost is just here, you know, like yeah, he's for gonna sure. pop out as a ghost looking translucent hologram. It's gonna be crazy. And the thing about the vault is like one of the things he did know he was dying in the books, mm-hmm. and then they kind of flash forward 35 years into Terminus as a colony, and he's already dead. Whether he got assassinated, died of old age, cancer, we don't really know in the books. But one of the reasons, you know, we said like the mystery of like how is he going to continue to influence the psychohistory project beyond the grave? Well,
this
you
is
know,
it.
With his psychohistory, and he sees much further than even Gale has at this point. He's and they allude to this in the show that like, oh, this is this isn't the Empire's first crisis and it won't be the last. He knows
that it'll last at least 30,000 years. So he's seen very far into the future.
Right. But he's got this inflection points in human history that he calls Seldon crises.
Yeah.
And when these things occur where his followers are going to be like, fuck, this wasn't part of the plan. His holograph comes to life and gives them a piece of wisdom or a new piece of information mm-hmm. or some other thing to work on to try to bend the arc back into the direction. So I think, yeah, we're about to, we might even next episode, if they continue telling this Salvar Hardin story, we might see the first of those, inflections. Yeah.
Yeah. It sets him up as like this mythical figure, right? This larger than life, sort of a god, but not really. And there are a lot of people who like buck against his wisdoms, that come out of this vault. And I think. Yeah, a lot. It's super interesting what they do, but they've set it up nothing like the book did. So,
right.
Because in the book, right. like the foundation springs up around these vaults. The vaults are like part of their society, right? And mm-hmm. you get maybe a hint of that here if Salvor is able to kind of walk up to one of these things that maybe, you know, mm-hmm. it's something the foundation controls. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they have eventually boards of directors. Council members that sort of wait for these vaults to open. They right. kind of know when they're going to happen roughly.
Right.
At least that first one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's very different here.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the other thing I thought were different from the books. Correct me if I'm wrong, but like, because again, this is a lot of allegory to the fall of the Roman Empire. You heard Lee Pace, Brother Day, talk about the barbarian kingdoms, and we met two of these. What was it?
Anacreon and Thespis.
Yeah. So the foundation, once the central galactic empires begin to fall and they can no longer kind of protect their borders and interests, it's kind of like a wild, wild west. And Terminus is here with this huge collection of scientists and engineers that have like this vast wealth of knowledge and experience. And these barbarian realms are going to take an active interest. In the books, I recall them being more of just like, these are just the human planets that are out next into us in the outer reaches of the galaxy. I like the idea that they're more of a central part from the, you know, their linchpin. We started to see these civilizations. We started to see how they're interacting, dissatisfaction with the Empire, all that kind of stuff mm-hmm. before they're going to play a larger part in probably the middle and later parts of these seasons.
They've
I thought that's a
much,
good change.
Much better job. Yeah. The narrative here is so much clearer, so much more connected than the book. The book is really a series of vignettes taking place over, I think that first book is 80-ish years. And it's just like, you know, people in rooms talking and they're very disconnected and you get the sense that they only connect on a meta level where you see the development of the foundation. But yeah, it seems like they're doing a lot more here. And I was kind of surprised we didn't do that 35-year jump in the end of this episode where and maybe we do. Maybe the death of Harry is like the event that we needed to see that we then jump forward X amount of years and start telling that story. But the death of Harry is another wild one because, it happens, but we don't know how it happens. this is setting a trajectory. I mean, Gale is not a big part of the book at all. At all. Mm. She's like someone who's there to give us insight into what psychohistory is and then leaves. Right.
She's an excuse for Harry Seldon to expound upon the tenets of psychohistory, because else why, it gives an in-universe reason for why this guy would just start up an explanation for the science why would else he do that, you know?
Yeah, and then I think she's in like the first part of the establishment of the foundation, and then Hardin becomes kind of the main, Salvor, whose last name is Hardin. I don't think they say that in the show, but Salvor is going to become like the main protagonist of the foundation going forward, which is also another reason that I appreciate the framing device here, because you need to introduce that character.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously, we talked about the emperors are not like, you know, there is an Emperor Cleon, but he is just kind of like a minor figure that is mentioned during the trial of Harry. This is the head of the emperor, but he doesn't concern himself. The attack, like I said, all that stuff is better, you know, like having these things. Mm-hmm. Number one, gives you an infusion of action, like, you know, having super soldiers assault a facility and take out scientists and torture them by severing their spinal cords. That gives the audience like, that gets our pulse moving. The attack on the space station, the Star Bridge, the destruction of Trantor, the reprisals that they do on the outer planets. That stuff gives you that much needed kind of like, energy to the otherwise interesting but maybe very dry characters and ideas that we've been talking about. Raish is not in the foundation. He's in the prequels, I understand, where he plays a role that's kind of similar to Gal in those, or Gale. You got me doing it now.
Yeah, sorry.
So like that is interesting how they're bringing that relationship in here. And like I said, Demerzel, again, when he wrote the Foundation series, Asimov wasn't thinking about having all these being connected. In fact, the Foundation wasn't even a book. It was a series of short stories written over in science fiction novels that got collected into parts. And then those various parts, I think the first Foundation series has four different parts, like the psycho historians, you've got the emperors, and then the Fuckface McGee. There's always this collection of like, the different things that go through. Whereas this is all like, you know, someone as like, imagine if Asimov had a chance to like go back and tell the story from the very beginning.
Yeah.
He might do something like this where he weaves in some of more of those ideas of like, I always wanted to merge the robot series and Empire series with this series. So he would do that stuff. I think David Goya? I've forgotten his name.
Goyer,
David S. Goyer. I think he's going through and trying to do that right now. And that gives him a good opportunity to get more character, more human emotion, and more action, crucially, into the series.
Yeah. There's also this other character who is not a part of the books. Not that I read, named Gerald, who's kind of like the liaison to the Empire here with Gale, and it reminds me a lot, the energy he's got going reminds me just to the T of Dean Stockwell from Quantum Leap, right? He's like the dude with the data pad standing next to Scott Bakula going, pulling all the strings. I really, really saw a lot of that energy coming from him. I don't know what his role is going to be going forward, because he's not really part of the book that I read.
He seems like it'd be a spy type of role. I wonder if we'll see him, especially now that Gale has been taken off the board. What if he infiltrates we'll know who he is, but I don't think anyone else in the Foundation would. So I kind of like, if he's going to go forward, like being some kind of secret agent or spy within the facility. Which I can't remember if that's does the Imperium ever try to subvert the Foundation?
The Empire is not a part of that first book, other than the trial and the exile.
So it falls to shit almost immediately then.
Well, I don't think it does. I think
they're
fine.
Just so far away it doesn't. Nothing is okay.
Place in Terminus and the Four Kingdoms and all that.
All right. What else?
That's about it.
Okay. Well, like I said, I was nervous going into this. I actually wasn't until I read the Steppenwolf review, and then I got super nervous. But like the first two, and again, the wheels could fall off. This is a tough. Everyone said this was going to be a tough adaptation because it's got so many big ideas. It's so thin on the characters. It spans so many years. This is one of the last of the unfilmable things, you know, that everyone's always talked about. And then people film them, you know, like, oh, Lord of the Rings is unfilmable. Game of Thrones, unfilmable. Now we've got to Foundation. Maybe it is unfilmable. But from what I saw, like, none of the things that seemed to like bug Alan bugged me. And I was really engaged. But then again, I'm also inclined to give hard science fiction a pretty wide berth. But I didn't see anything that was like really cringy or just patently absurd. I mean, some people are talking about the hyperspace pods having their own individual windows as being dumb. But I'm like, it's a luxury liner, man. Yeah, it's got space windows. It's fine. It's fine. Every individual crouch, you know, that the Emperor wants when you drop out of hyperspace to Trantor, the first thing you see is his magnificence, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't have a problem with any of the choices other than nitpicks about design elements, but
no, this thing's like candy to me, man. I love sci-fi. I was noticing when I was looking at how beautiful this was and how cool everything looked and the concepts being realized. Like, you know, I bet this is how people feel about Avengers, right? If you're a big comic book fan and you've always wanted to see Avengers on screen, you're like, God, that looks incredible. For me, it's just like, that's another overblown CG thing. This is my Avengers. I love sci-fi and it looks incredible.
It's a properly blown CGI thing.
Yeah.
Well, we will be back next week to see what happens to Harry Seldon and his little project, the Foundation. See what happens with that vault and the null field. I'm wondering if we will find out immediately what goes on with Gale. I think it would be very jarring if a central figure just gets sideboarded for a lot of the season. So I expect we're not going to have to think too much longer to see if she comes back. But it's also, man, if you look at the trailer, it's always shocking to me how much of the trailers of these seasons comes out of the first few episodes, but almost all, as far as I could tell, a lot of stuff came out of the various trailers came out of these first 2 hours of the television show. Yeah. So it means probably going to be a lot of surprises in store for us. But we'll be back for episode 3 next week. One final reminder, foundation@baldmove.com is where you email your takes for us to consider on the show. We'll be back next week with episode 3. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.